Welcome back to the podcast. My guest today is a former Ketchikan resident turned Ketchikan resident again, as many people do in Southeast. They find their way home after time down in the lower crazy 48. At one point was a dance and theater professor at University of Alaska Anchorage, and now a middle school teacher here in Ketchikan. Thanks for being on here, Ty.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're a senior in high school. Do you think about one day coming back to Ketchikan, or as soon as you graduated high school, were you out of here?
Oh no, I was ready. There was, you know, and it was, you mentioned that I taught at University of Alaska Anchorage, and part of that job was trying to drum up interest for the program among Anchorage high school seniors. But I knew going into that, and I would say this in our meetings, of like, it's going to be very challenging. I mean, there is, you know, there's going to be the group of kids who want to stay close to home for whatever reasons, if it's comfort, familiarity, financial, whatever that is. But I know as a high school senior, there is no option that would have kept me in Alaska.
Right.
The whole experience was just get out of here.
Yeah, I think that's what most people feel, and it's good for them to feel that, and then come back on your own terms. A lot of kids who are stuck here, that's tough because you never know. And some kids have really good options to stay, but there's still that lingering possibility of what could you have done out there? And like, is this what you really would have wanted? But who knows?
Well, I tell my students that, you know, now be like, yeah, they still somehow they miss a lot of things. Like, where'd you go to school? I'm like, right here, kids. I had math in the room I teach in. What I tell them is, come back to Ketchikan, you know, that's great. We want people, especially, you know, people that have grown up in Southeast and are interested in being here as adults. But it's crucial to leave for a while, for whatever that is, college, a year, whatever. Like, go see the world and know, not just read about it, like, experience that there are other places.
Yeah.
And it'll highlight for you what this place is missing and what makes it special, what makes it great. And then come back.
Yeah.
But do get out, very seriously.
Coming back with skills and experiences you can leverage is so important, because then it's, I came back with the training to be able to be a teacher, or if someone's going to be an entrepreneur, they have a business background or they have some marketing background, so you can open up a business and you have an idea of the way things run down south and here, and it just, it can work.
Yeah.
If you just have nothing, then it's tough anywhere.
Yeah. But. Yeah, no, I'm a fan of... seeing other places, and even, you know, with the small town nature of Ketchikan, even if you hate big cities, I think it's important to experience them and understand. I mean, for me, that was New York. But even, I think it's good to go back for the reminder of what Seattle is, or even Portland, and, you know, to get those experiences. And again, I think it just highlights, like, oh, right, I get to go back and I have, you know, whatever your friend group or your family or whatever that connection is that makes this place special, along with, you know, the outdoor opportunities. Like, living in New York is like the very opposite, because it's also an island, right? You know, in Manhattan, and then you have all concrete except for Central Park and, you know, and Inwood Park, but these little green areas that are, in the case of Central Park, largely man-made. You know, they left a couple rocks in place so they could say it was like a natural feature, but you know, that are covered. And so it's very much the opposite of here, where we've got our, you know, five blocks of town and then wilderness.
Yeah.
So it is. I think it is good to get those experiences. It highlights for you what is great about this place.
A buddy of mine, when I was in California, tried out for Blue Man Group, didn't get it. And then the second trial, got it. So it was in his first, like, trial run part in New York. So I went out there to visit him. And he was in one of those tiny closet of an apartment studio things. There were rats.
Oh, yeah.
and it was wild to walk around on the street and just not get the full expanse of the sky. To only see it in those long blue rectangles. And there's no open up unless you get all the way down. What's the south end of the island there? The Battery Park or something
Battery
like that?
Battery Park.
Yeah. Then you can look out and you can see kind of the the sky and then get to Central Park, and but it's still just a huge rectangle. That was just so wild, and
yeah,
I don't want to say claustrophobic, but it was weird to be able to walk for so long and never get totally open and clear sky view.
Oh yeah, and you're never, you know, you're never alone. Sometimes I'll have students or, you know, other people largely from here would be like, you know, isn't it dangerous? I'm like, I never felt that in New York, because there's so many people. You're never alone. Mm-hmm. Any time of day or night. It's usually well lit. You know, it's different when you get further out into the boroughs, but in Manhattan, you're never alone. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be lit. It is 24/7. People, people, people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the things a couple of my students have talked about safety, and they're worried about safety. And I thought, okay, well, when I was leaving from Kluwak, first of all, male, it's different. You know, if you're a female, yeah, there's just kind of an ever-present difference. But now you hear every story about any sort of horrible thing that happens to someone, someone who was just walking down the street by themselves or someone who was even with friends. And so I thought about what that must do to someone's psyche. You're in Ketchikan, things are safe, you know people, and then you are going to Seattle for college, or you are going to Portland, you are going to New York, how that must feel potentially. You know, is it going to be safe? Like, what other resources? How are people going to be, or how is campus, what is campus doing to ensure that I am pretty safe? And there's a lot of things out there, and it's good. And I hope that it's kind of a passing thought. Mm-hmm. It's not bad to be aware whatsoever, you know, maybe prevent certain situations, but being totally fearful, at least on some level at all times, is not healthy whatsoever.
No. And I think a lot of that is just your perception through whatever those channels are, TV, news, your family, mm-hmm, filtering that through the news, you know, that whole, you know, where are you getting these ideas from? Because depending on your source, you could think, oh no, it's chaos and end of times.
Yeah.
But, you know, of the big cities that I've lived in, and I would say that I would consider lived in as in, you know, more than 2 months in, mm-hmm, a place, but I've lived in New York, Seattle, Portland, Kansas City, Louisville, Kentucky. And the only really dangerous city that I've lived in where I was robbed, one neighbor killed the other one and had my tires slashed in the first month that I lived there, was Anchorage.
Really?
By far the most dangerous city I've lived in.
Yeah, it's like Los Anchorage, man. Dude, like, gosh.
Not even close. Yeah, New York, yeah, not a problem. Louisville, Kansas City, there were some places where they're like, you just do not go there. You know, Seattle, like if you're, you know, even like catching the bus downtown at night, now you're like, whoa, yeah, we have gone downhill.
Yeah.
Still Anchorage. Yeah. It's the only place where I had like actual violence,
yeah,
perpetrated on me and neighbors.
I got held up at gunpoint my junior year of college in Tucson. And that was, you get enough blocks from campus and then you're not in that same ecosystem of people who,
yep,
have some relation to college or, you know, people have a different direction, different life choices.
Whatnot. For sure.
And it can be spotty in certain areas, but you can usually tell this is a good spot. This is not a good spot. This is a good spot to be at certain times. Went to a Yankee game and we weren't sure which station to get off at.
Oh yeah.
And someone was like, you going to the Yankee game? I'm like, yeah, you get off at the next one. And I was like, oh, thanks. Great. Cause that was kind of the local person saying, hey, you know, this is a good decision for you to make would be to get off here.
Yeah.
You don't need to tempt certain things. And that was good.
Yeah. But
people are very helpful too. And that's something that, yeah, someone might not know. Just there's a lot of people who are looking out for you way more than looking to prey off you.
So first time I went to New York, I was, I think I was 19, and I was going to college in Oregon and went out to visit. I was thinking about transferring to one of the schools out there because pursuing a theater degree, you know, is always that debate of do you train away from the big artistic centers and then go to the place so that you're learning without as many distractions. Mm-hmm. I certainly found enough of them though. Or do you go right to the heart of the thing where you can see it being done? So I went to check that out and I was going to stay with a woman from Ketchikan who was a Rockette. Mm. And I did not communicate very well. You know, this is 1999, and it was bad communication on my part. So I showed up at her apartment and hadn't communicated that I was coming into town, or not recently communicated it, you know? And I was standing out front, and finally, gosh, I don't even know how I was ringing her bell and didn't happen. And some guy going into her, into the same building, looked down and saw my duffel bag, which was Ketchikan High School men's basketball. And he was like, "Are you here to see Jenny?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Come on in." And I'm like, "Oh, but this is not what I heard about New York, you know?" And then guy, just based on that, he knew, oh, he sees Ketchikan. I know my neighbors from Ketchikan, small town. Come on up. Invited me into his home.
Oh, wow.
You know, gave me something to drink and had her number. I called her. She's like, "Oh, I'm staying out with my boyfriend in Brooklyn tonight." It's why I had to figure something else out. But that was my very first experience in New York. I was like super ignorant.
Yeah.
Where like I really did the thing where when I, my first night there, I just kind of stood in Times Square and just people watched and looked at the amount of lights and serious.
It's crazy.
Serious. It's crazy. Yokel.
That's the funny thing. Remember, I think it was the first year I was teaching down in California, and we played a game Thursday night and Friday night. I was a basketball coach. And I was like, "I'm going to go ride my bike over to my buddy Gary's house. He's another assistant coach, and just like talk about the game." So I ride my bike over, and it's like 9:30 in the morning. I knock on the door, and he's like, "What are you doing, man?" I was like, "Oh, I just decided, you know, come on by." Like, there's just that different. You didn't have to make reservations. And that might be – that was Kluwak or Southeast Alaska or Alaska in general, but also the time period. Like, you didn't necessarily have to carve out time. It was just, "I'm going to stop by. We're going to stop by and visit." That was kind of the old thing that you did, and – it was just kind of shocking and a culture difference there.
Yeah.
What were some of the biggest culture changes and how did you cope with them when you were back there?
I mean, there's from the kind of the daily things that are hard to get used to, because in Ketchikan, I mean, it's sort of the, you know, the two different Ketchikans of the summer tourism time and then the winter where it kind of goes back to the town as we know it. But there is still that sense of, when you're out in public here, if you're at the store, if you're walking on the street, you acknowledge people, you make eye contact, and whether you say hi or not, you acknowledge the other person. In New York, that is the opposite. You do not want to invite that contact.
End up looking like Buddy the Elf.
Totally. That, and if you're on the subway, you're like, if you're making contact, like you are engaging with someone who either does not want you to engage with them, or you're going to engage with someone whose attention you do not want. So that was just that alone was tricky for me to navigate of like, oh, right. Do not acknowledge, just keep going. Generally the pace of it, not just the physical nature of, you know, here in Ketchikan, like my dad's a retired administrator. So like going to the store just by myself is, you know, I'm going to run into however many people I know, but going to the store with him is a whole event. That could take you 2 hours at Safeway.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to talk shop with everybody and a thousand different things there like that. You never just go to do a thing. Like one of my favorite things to do in New York was just go walk around. Every four blocks, it's a different world. You're hearing different languages spoken, the food, the aesthetic changes, and that is really fascinating. But there, if you live and work there, you know, you have a clear goal, and it's that time is money ethic is prevalent there. That ultimately became the thing that I really didn't like, that idea that time is money. If you are in my way, whether that's physically or otherwise, you are an obstacle to my goal, which is make money, which is succeed, do this thing. So that super goal-oriented, this is how it's done, hustle, 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 that's a large culture shock. Ultimately, one that I just didn't want to spend my time doing.
So was the dream to make it in New York, and then once you got there, you realized that wasn't the exact dream, or did you morph that, or how did that work out?
Well, I think, I mean, I grew up where most of my interaction with acting and such is movies and TV. But all of my experience was theater, locally for City Players and K-High Drama Club, those kinds of things. So my idea when I went to college for classical theater training, and that's what I wanted to do. I think ultimately I probably wanted to, at that time, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival had 75 full-time actors who got 9 or 10 month equity contracts that had a livable wage. You could get a home in Ashland and live in a small community, kind of similar to Ketchikan, mm-hmm. yet work at this Tony Award-winning theater, you know, and basically have a professional, high-end professional theater experience in life while living in this small town in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that was like ultimately a dream. And then as I progressed more and more and kind of learned more about the craft, I think that the Broadway, more specifically off-Broadway, because Broadway is going to be, you know, I don't know, not an actual statistic, but probably about, I would say 75% of Broadway is large musicals. Mm-hmm. And that's never been my interest or my skill set, to be clear, but not my interest. So I always wanted to do like plays, and to be able to do that at a high level in New York. And I think as I learn more and more, then like the dream kind of becomes, I would love to be able to do like independent films, maybe one or two a year, and then be able to work in the theater, to be a working actor. That was the dream. But then, you know, it like sets in that in order for that to be your dream, you need to be able to live in really like New York or Chicago or LA if you're going to do pure film. And that ultimately, that was not the experience that I wanted. I think I got to the point where I liked living in New York more than not. I kind of got up to about 4 days a week. I liked it, but the other three, I was like, no. Mm-hmm. Why am I doing this? I hate being with millions of people on 13 miles and
yeah,
you know, just that, the constant hustle like that. That was ultimately not what I wanted to do. I knew at some point I wanted, like, you know, the outdoors are too important to me to, you know, you can access the outdoors there, but it takes some serious effort. Yeah. And Southeast Alaska will spoil you for other places.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
So, that became part of it where I realized, oh, I had this dream about the work, but I, at no point was I thinking the work requires that you enjoy living your life in the places where you have to do that work. Because the thing that I love, theater, requires an audience. Mm-hmm. And that audience does not exist everywhere.
Yeah.
And not at that level, right? Where you can do 6 shows a year, and make any kind of a living from it. That exists in a very few pockets in our country. So like that piece just didn't factor in. And when I realized, oh, there are other things like quality of life pieces are more important, family, mm-hmm. You know, even like climate things, you know, I'm realizing like, oh wow, that's interesting. I don't need it to be especially warm and I don't mind rain.
Yeah.
So like those are things that you don't really like, people freaking out over rain, looking around like, what the hell is wrong with you guys? It's just sprinkling. Yeah, it's not even real rain. Shame on you.
This is a dry rain.
Yeah, it's a dry rain. Yeah. It's what?
Yeah.
So, you know, those are things that I ultimately had to come to terms with. And even that took me a process of, I started to work more in, I mean, I had some medical things that brought me back to the Northwest, particularly Portland. And I went to college in Ashland. And so I had a lot of theater connections in the Portland area. So I just kind of ended up working in that area, and between Portland and Seattle, I ended up doing plays there and working there, and having my doctors were at Oregon Health Sciences. So I just ended up kind of moving there before I really intended to. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I'm spending more time here anyway. Let's just move back to the Northwest. Mm-hmm. And then did that. And, trying to think, the move back to Ketchikan, it was sort of in pieces. We came back and ended up trying to remember why we were here in the winter, but we came back in the winter and we were working. I was actually a para in at K-High, and gosh, this must have been about 2012. I think that's right. And the guy who Alex McDonald at the time was the Kaneyama exchange teacher, and he had just gotten back and was like, I had a great time, I loved it. They don't have a teacher right now. And I casually mentioned that to my wife, and she's like, yeah, they don't have an exchange teacher. And she was like, let's do it. I want to do it. I'm like, no, wait, whoa. You know, pump the brakes there. You're a little excited. Think about all these. She's like, I don't care what you do. I want to go do that. So she applied and was the teacher. And so we went over to Kaneyama and were set to be there. She went over right away, and I was finishing a show in Portland. And then I went over 2 months after her. I got there by October, and then pretty quickly thereafter, we got pregnant. And so at that time, I was like, oh, wow, yay, that's wonderful. Oh, wow, I need to get a job. I mean, like a big boy job, not like a $200 a week equity minimum job. And so it was from Japan that I applied to University of Alaska Anchorage. For the teaching job there. And I hadn't even heard about that, but I knew that I had to get back to the States and kind of get established with a more of a long-term job. So also from Japan, I applied for a fish and game job with Sport Fish. There was a year-round position at that time. So came over and started that. And then I ended up getting the job in Anchorage. So we were living in Ketchikan when she came back from Japan. She was in Japan for the first two trimesters and then came back last 3 months, had our daughter here in Ketchikan. And then 3 weeks after she was born, moved to Anchorage and lived there for the first 5 years of her life.
And then how long were you up there until you moved back here?
So I was up there. I ended up being up there 6 years. They were up there. They were up there for five because our program got cut. The theater and dance department got cut. And that was, so I knew that I only had a year left to teach because they gave, I was, you know, low man. So I knew I was the first one out. So I knew that we only had a year left, but then COVID shut us down.
Oh yeah.
So my wife and daughter went to stay with her family down in the Atlanta area. And I continued teaching at the university from Alaska for a little bit. Then I gathered up all of our stuff in our Subaru and drove from Anchorage to Atlanta during COVID.
Whoa.
Like early COVID.
Wow.
I had to have, to get into Canada, I had to have a terminated lease in Anchorage and a lease for renting a place in Georgia just to get through. We were just staying with her mom for a little while, so it turned out it was really good that my mother-in-law is a real estate agent, so she could like come up with that document.
Yeah,
so that
yeah.
I knew that there I needed something to get into Canada. Like, let me show you my plan.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to camp here forever.
Yeah.
So did that, and then I finished teaching online as we were all learning the Zoom thing, which was fine for like my seminar classes where I was basically lecturing or, you know, I could give assignments. But one of the classes I had was voice for the actor, which is just stupid to do because it's entirely dependent on how good is the mechanism amplifying your voice. You know, it's a class designed for teaching you how to speak in large, open physical spaces. So
no doubt.
I feel terrible for the kids that had what a useless class that was. But anyway, so finished that. I got to go back. Thankfully, you know, we only had after spring break. And then that was the end of that year. So I finished there. I got to go back and teach in person the next year. I mean, it was still like COVID protocol, which was, you know, I taught a stage combat class was masked and socially distanced.
It's not as cool.
Well, not as cool. And also like when you're teaching an unarmed combat fight, it's also the distancing part is proximity is necessary.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's kind of how that happened. Yeah, that was our journey up there. So they ended up being there 5 years. I ended up being up there 6 years. And then we're in, after the work ended there, I actually just wanted to see, because that was COVID shut everything down. And then that next year, we still didn't have the cruise ships coming back. And I was just curious, like, what is Ketchikan like without cruise ships? So that's how I convinced my wife. I'm like, I just have to go see. I just want to go check it out for the summer. And we loved it, of course. And so we ended up staying and in the fall, just didn't leave like we had planned to, and put our daughter into kindergarten. And here we are.
Yeah. It's an important thing is to see kind of the dream through to some sort of end, which is cool. So even though it ends up being just a crazy route, involves different areas of the country and whatnot, at least you pursued, at least you kind of know and followed that. And then it came to an end-ish, but, you know, at least on your own terms. The kids that go to college for a semester and don't like it and come home, well, was that it's not meant for you, or was it more like a fear type thing? So seeing it through and just kind of going on that ride and seeing how long that takes. And sometimes the ride is a couple of years. Sometimes you never come back, but at least you're doing the thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we had a lot of kids that were, a good percentage of our students up there were from Anchorage or the Valley. We had a handful. I think I had one from Juneau, one from Sitka. But then we get kids from the villages, and it was really hard, that transition. Excuse me. Like the big thing was, if you started in the fall and made it the first month, that was like one marker of pretty good success. Inevitably, they're all homesick.
Yeah.
Understandable. Even I ended up loving where I went to undergrad in Ashland, Oregon, but even going by, I remember coming back to Ketchikan over Christmas break and being like, I don't like it. It feels all kind of off. But then by the end of the break, I'm like, maybe I want to go back and see my friends, and ended up loving it. But that is after Christmas is like, who came back? Because a lot of the kids, especially the kids from the villages, just too much, too many distractions without that network of family. It was really hard. There were few students that made it into the program and came back after Christmas.
Yeah.
After those large breaks.
Place like, or even Kluwak, my parents took me down to Colorado every summer. And so, you know, I was able to see what the world was about, and I wasn't very intimidated by it. So I knew I could function. So that was good. And living here in Ketchikan, you see so many different people. There's so many different jobs. You're communicating with people. You're a dock rep, or as 15-year-old, you're a kayak guide or something like that. So
both those things.
Yeah. It's so different than a kid from the village who hasn't had that experience.
Yeah.
And so even though there's so many people who are willing to help them out and to be resources, even though it's Anchorage, you know, which is still in the state, it's just still so different.
And it's a different world.
It's tough. And I know there's a lot of, I think, you know, tuition help or even free at UAF and those areas, just trying to, you know, get some training. So if you want to go back to the village, that's great. But what skills you can have to leverage, like entrepreneurship or marketing or, you know, something to be healthy and go back there and provide something and be of service to that. And that's, but it's impossible to say the right thing to some of the kids and have them really believe it. And it's, you know, they're not losers. They're not quitters. It's just the circumstances sometimes are too much.
And the social piece is the hard thing that I don't even know how you can kind of prepare yourself for that. For me, college was just enough distractions.
Yeah,
for sure. But like, and it's even coming from an experience like, I think similar, like we would go to the lower 48 every, like our thing was, my parents were both originally from Oregon. So we'd get in our little Ford Escort, four door, mom, dad, and me and my sister, and take the ferry to Rupert, drive to Southern Oregon, you know, 3 days in the tiny car, and then be down there for largely like June and then come back up for the summer. But even that much kind of gives you that sense of, you know, you drive through or around Seattle and Portland and you see that chaos and just see like the similarities and differences of other little towns in the Northwest, like that much help, but very different setup where all of a sudden, boom.
So now you're back and you're able to not only teach, provide purpose that way, but also you're still involved in theater. Tell me about The Ladder. Was it, it was originally a short film and now it's full length. What's going on there?
Yeah. So the first time I heard about it, so it was written and directed by, Emilio Miguel Torres, who was, who grew up in Ketchikan. I don't think he actually finished high school here. I think his family ultimately moved when he was maybe sophomore in high school, but he grew up here. And the first time I heard about it, it was like around Blueberry Festival a few years ago while Emilio was still, I think he was still in grad school at NYU or still in school. And, it might've been undergrad. I can't remember, but he was at NYU and his dad, who I'd done plays with here at First City Players, saw me at Safeway. I was like, oh yeah, Emilio's writing the story. He's going to do it all here. And yeah, he's looking to shoot it maybe next year or something. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Nice. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, that timing's rough. I'll be in Anchorage. And so, but that's really cool. Glad to know he's doing it. And so then I saw that the short came out and watched that. I'm like, that's cool. Good. It's like, you know, good story. And it's awesome that he's actually like shooting it here in town, using local actors. and then, yeah, last fall, I can't remember how I heard, maybe he'd reached out, but I just heard like, yeah, he got the funding to make it or I saw it at Blueberry Festival that they had a booth and they were fundraising there and like, yeah, we're trying to generate funds to make it a feature length. I'm like, oh, awesome. They had auditions. So I auditioned, you know, it was an open call, got sides, went to First City Players, and he was with the producers in Arizona, watching us audition in person via Zoom, and then did the callback kind of part of it, and then with the casting, you know, he had to do all of the initial rehearsals via Zoom. Oof. And then, yeah, it was crazy, and then it was my first time on a film. I'd done student largely like student short films, like 10 minutes or less, 6 minute shows, something like that. Like a little bit. So I'd been in front of the camera, like barely. This is absolutely my first movie, first thing over 10 minutes long. And it is a feature length. I don't know what it's going to come out to be once it's all edited, but probably hour and a half, 2 hour range.
What's the basic storyline?
So the basic storyline is that there, a fisherman from Ketchikan is
actually,
yeah,
better be.
Yes, of course. Yeah. as he's aging and starting to experience these, you know, his body breaking down, there's the main plot is that there's this firm and this sort of, these are my words, not Emilio, but like my understanding is it's a sort of like Elon Musk type figure who you have the question mark of like, is there any kind of societal ethical purpose or is this purely a money-making endeavor? But the idea is in this sort of sci-fi way that they can basically upload your consciousness, your memories and thoughts and all the things, and then put it back into a younger body. Mm. So that is the main idea of the film, is that there's this new technology that is being piloted in a few communities, Ketchikan being one of them, where they're taking an aging elderly population, uploading their memories and putting them into younger bodies. And so the protagonist is debating, do I do this so I can continue fishing and doing the things that I love? And his son, who I play, is from Ketchikan, lives in New York. and comes back to visit. And we kind of learn pretty quickly that his son is in the marketing world in New York, and his wife is a lawyer. And we find out that her company is currently in some type of litigation with that sort of Elon Musk type figure. So we get the sense, without going into it much, that he's possibly shady.
Yeah.
So then that is the question of, do I try this experimental thing and become 22 again, essentially, with all of my lived experiences and knowledge, or do I accept my life cycle and, that central metaphor of the ladder at Creek Street there of, do I, climb that ladder to finish, my life cycle as it is.
Wow.
So that's it's kind of the central idea of it.
What would you do?
That's a hell of a question. I mean, and we all actually talked about it. I think at the end of it, at some point, everyone would ask, and I have to think that ultimately I think I would just rather age naturally. Mm-hmm. I think I'm kind of that way anyway, where people talk about the technology of leaving the planet and, possibly we'll colonize this or that. I'm like, I feel pretty tied to this planet.
I like it. It's so nice.
Yeah. It's it's really when you think about it in those terms, I'm like, no, I think my fate is attached to what we've done here and how we've treated this thing. And I'm utterly connected to it.
Yeah. I had a student who sounded just really sad and really disappointed that I wouldn't go to Mars. And I was like, absolutely not. I said, well, what if it was safe? And what if you could go there and live and then come back if you wanted to? I was like, no, I'm good. I'm good here. It's fine. Yeah. The trout fishing, the salmon fishing, I'm good. And as far as the immortality or recycling through or whatever, it's so different now because it's not the same hypothetical of maybe the 70s or 80s when it was so far off to even ponder. It was, just a fun little exercise. But now with what we're doing with, Musk's Neuralink or AI or these other opportunities, by 2050, what if there is some sort of chance? And I don't know. I don't know.
I think for me, the ultimate tipping point on that question was thinking of it in context of living in a community with my parents and my daughter.
Right. Yeah.
So then at what point can I go and then become younger than my daughter?
That's weird.
Or do I want to see my mom as a 22-year-old? No, not especially. Or, things like it. Then the overlap and of okay, how many times can you do this? So then are we going to just go and go where we have this millennia old consciousness in a fireproof 20-year-old body? That sounds maybe that first iteration is fun. And what are you going to do? Try to just ruin this body and just party your ass off? Or at what point do you be oh, okay, that's enough. Yeah. It's sort of that vampire thought of when you see the world change in a way that you were never meant to experience, can that be anything but ultimately sad and disappointing?
Yeah.
And I don't think I want any part of that.
It's such an individualized question, but if everybody has the same opportunity, then the exponential population growth, it's not going to exist the way we think it's going to exist. The use of the resources and again, the weird ethical sort of questions, but yeah, if it was just me and I was the only one that could do it, that would be way different than everybody doing it.
Right.
But, yeah, I would like to think that I would just kind of do things gracefully. But I don't know. When with the technology moving where it is, if everybody else is doing it, and there might be, again, if it's different, if it's not, maybe if your consciousness was able to be uploaded and it could be accessed by a computer, it's you go totally digital.
Yeah.
I'm accessible on the cloud. What?
Totally.
What is that? But life is life. Life is, interaction existence. It's not digitized, but maybe AI and the technology is going to change our perception of what life is or our definition of what life is.
It's an interesting question, especially too, when you look at, so in the world of acting, to kind of tie it in with that, that this was kind of a big thing that came out of the latest, like the SAG strike of wanting to get a better contract. And the thing that they didn't necessarily resolve is this new AI piece that I heard kind of describe it in like a similar level of, like, with AI, we're sort of at that like Oppenheimer moment that mm-hmm. There are so few people, you know, relatively that are aware that know that this is that moment where we don't really know what that's going to do or what it's going to look like. But there's this interview with like Mark Ruffalo was talking on this subject during the kind of the Oscar round tables. And he was saying, well, I know for me personally, Disney and Marvel have thousands of hours and biometric everything about me. It would be fairly easy, I think, for them to take this, what they have of me, mm-hmm. and that sort of lives on in perpetuity. And what do they do with that? It's up to an entity that is outside of myself. So that's sort of the next piece of that science fiction live forever of like, yeah, what do they do with that? Do you just, is your whole person or what they know of you and your biometrics and your consciousness, etc., whatever they get mm-hmm. or whatever piece they take of you and then try to generate the rest with AI or whatever that ends up being in my limited understanding. And that, yeah, you live on the cloud and maybe they just pluck your consciousness mm-hmm. out and put it where they, I mean, it's at a very interesting place.
Yeah. Soulless. Yeah. Yeah, it's terrifying. It's not like the machines. It's not the Terminator. It's the code and stuff. The fact that they uploaded code and it's making the code better, and so it's becoming more intelligent at a rate that is way faster. And if we don't know how to manage it now, it's not something that we can just kind of let out and control later. Yeah. So I listen to some podcasts with some smart people on it, and I just feel like I'm tinfoil hat guy. I want to unhear that so I can just kind of blissfully live my life. And hey, you know, we got tourists and we got cruise ships coming up. Oh, look, the baseball field's almost finished. I want to concern myself with that sort of stuff rather than the existential threat of what things are going to look like in 5-10 years.
No, I would much rather take the fly rod to the creek than think about, do I need to copyright my voice and personality so that it's not used later on by some other unknown entity.
It's
a lot.
I had a student, they did a podcast on AI in my journalism class, and one of the kids said,
cool,
she was worried that, because she doesn't use AI, hates the thought of it, she was worried about when she goes to college and what if she falls behind everybody else because they're using AI. So she's the one who is, it's her and her brain power and her own creativity, but what if she falls behind? And then another one mentioned about, again, she doesn't want to use AI at all. And she wants to be an occupational therapist. So what if she's trying to be as thoughtful and as human to her clients as possible or patients as possible? And would she be doing a disservice if she doesn't use AI?
Yeah.
And then, like, what is she a bad person because she's not? It's just a weird ethical series of questions going forward is for these kids trying to figure out what their world or what their career is going to look like in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be changing while they're going to school for it. It's pretty wild. Whereas as established teachers, like, we're living through it a totally different way, but these seniors, it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you guys have had conversations like this at K-High, but with the Schoenbar English faculty, like, we've talked about, like, how is this changing our field? And I mean, some of the obvious things are that we do most of all, I would say, not 100%, but over 90% of our written content with pencil and paper live in class. Mm-hmm. You know, that just kind of helped that along too. I mean, those are skills that are dwindling anyway. I want to see your ideas, the way that you can express them here in this place. But then thinking about, at some level, is that a disservice? Because how many of these students that we have right now are not going to have AI as some aspect of their future employment or to be able to interact with it in some way. And, you know, that's a whole nother can of worms. But like, and just thinking about the own, for my part, the own ethical piece of do I use AI or interact with it in any way? And I tried it for the first time where I was like, I want, we're having a hard time. Here's how I did it. And my students, they busted me right away too, because I kind of wanted them to see what they'd say. So when I projected it on my screen, I left the tab up that had ChatGPT on it. And they're like, what is that? I'm like, well, that's a great question. Good eye. But what I was working on, apositive phrases. And so rather than like come up with 10 brilliant phrases that would take me an hour, I was like, give me, you know, I can't remember what my prompt was, but it was something like, I want 10 different apositive phrases based on the rainforest. Spits them out. Amazon. Oh, no. Temperate rainforest. Oh, now we're getting into the Tongass. Okay. Now then, like, modified in 5 minutes. And I, you know, I had a challenging and interesting exercise for them to work on for a day. And I was like, oh, that's dangerous, because I see how, like, the amount of manpower, brain power that I could be doing other tasks or whatever. Like, I could see that being useful in that way. But then that question of, like, well, what is the... If it's something like that where it doesn't require a personal or human element, to me that seems like one thing. Whereas, like, I don't even really like you. Grammarly pisses me off. Even as an English teacher, my writing is fairly ugly. And I'm like, I know that's not right, but that's what I want it to sound like. You know what I mean? Where I'd rather have that human element. I'd rather see the mistake and know what you meant. Like, I worry about, like, I like that writing of, like, you know, I hope AI can't perfectly replicate Ken Kesey. And, like, that's what I love about sometimes a great Notion is those great authors teach you how to read their material. So that as you're going, you have to listen. You have to know the character's voice to realize that the narration has changed in the middle of the paragraph. But I love that. And that's the piece that I worry about being lost.
I think being able to use it as a tool is the important thing. And that's the, when you're talking about being an efficient teacher, I can do the thing, but it's easy to come up with supplemental exercises or worksheets for the kids to do. So it's like, I could spend a lot of time doing this, but I can also use AI to make it quicker, more efficient, and then I can make it more mine. But I can I still have the skill to do it myself. The thing that concerns me is the kids who never really learned that skill. And we were just talking about how our journeys to where we're at now had so many turns. It took so many turns. And so if you think as an eighth grader, ninth grader, well, I'm not going to do anything that has to do with English, so I'm going to cheat on every essay and I'm never going to read the book. You're not interacting with the language. You're not practicing thinking. You're not practicing processing. You're not critical thinking, any of those sort of things. You're not doing any of that. So if you decide that you wanted to do this trade and then you decide you don't, then what? Or what if your journey takes you to something else and you have an opportunity to be a manager, but, or there's something that you don't have that skill because you undermined your education and your interaction with information or your relationship with education. It's like, I don't like this, but I'm going to do what I need to. I'm going to practice discipline and I'm going to learn this because all these things are tools, everything. And so I can use AI as a tool, but I can also do the thing. And it's hard to convince kids that that's an important thing too.
I think you hit it with that word discipline. It is. It's like, it's not easy. You're right. it's not. You have to, it is, you know, it is a habit. You have to challenge yourself. I mean, I think I saw like a basketball stat where like a Gonzaga player was raised in Japan and it made the coach think like, why are these Japanese students, for example, succeeding at such a higher level in, look at this one subject, like math, rather than the American students? And they kind of looked at the different things and they realized that this particular study was looking at the amount of like real struggle that the American students were really in that kind of struggle zone for like 2% of the time, whereas those Japanese students were in the struggle zone for like 40% of the time. And that ultimately, like, that is that necessary piece of like with your mind, it's struggling on a question that may be frustrating or whatever. And in, you know, like what makes the outdoors great of like, yeah, it's, if anyone could, we just trot up Deer Mountain all the time, but that thing is hard. Mm-hmm. It remains hard.
Yeah.
You could do, last summer I tried doing Deer Mountain 3-4 times a week, just up to the first lookout. It is, it does not get easier.
It's slick some days more than others. Yeah. Conditions.
So that the struggle is the thing. Mm-hmm. Like it should be hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the hard that makes it great. Right. Yeah. You know, and, anyway, I kind of got on that tangent there, but like, that's the thing where I think we're working against multiple challenges in that, writing by hand and getting your thoughts down is difficult anyway, because writing, you know, is a linear process. You can go back and edit it in different ways in terms of like plot structure and all of that, but the getting the thoughts down, it is a linear process, you know, and that it like the sentence gets more complicated the further to the right you move the verb, and but like those rules are intact, and it does take the through line of thought to get to that, and not just that is challenging by itself, and it was 1,000 years ago, but now with the constant amount of content that we're streaming and we're seeing in these maximum 3-second clips, and like restructuring and reordering our brains and the way that we understand and see things is like challenging that even further, where that sitting down, taking one task, one idea, moving it forward in a linear fashion, that is hard.
Yeah.
And you have to have the discipline to do it. But then I wonder, like, if you don't get that rudimentary skill, where does that show up later? Like, are you, you know, are we going to see a gap in that ability to think through a thing linearly? And
yeah. And that's how you get the confidence too. By doing difficult things, you build your confidence because you accomplish that. And that's so huge. But we're coming up on an hour here. So, to finish up with the ladder there, how can people support it? How can they watch it? When can they watch it? All that stuff.
Yeah. So the first big thing about the ladder is we've shot all of it. Our last, about a month ago, Keith Smith and I, Keith plays Arthur, the protagonist, and I play his son, we flew out to New York and shot the last remaining like 3 or 4 scenes. They got one more scene there. So it's all in the can, as they say. All of it is done. Now it's post-production, which it's an independent film, not huge, but still it's an expensive process. So Emilio's looking to fund the remaining amount of money needed for post-production so that it does become a reality and we can see it on the big screen. And he's about 30% through that. So he is having a fundraiser up at K-Hi, not this Saturday. No, I lie. What is this? Oh, yeah. No, it's the 10th already. Wow. Dang. So this Saturday, the 13th at K-Hi, I think doors at 5:30. The event starts at 6 o'clock, and it's to try to get the funding for the ladder kind of over the finish line. And it's a $25 event. You know, it's a donation to come in, and we're going to do a Q&A. Myself, Heidi Poet, who plays my wife in the film, Emilio is there to facilitate as the director and the writer. And there's going to be some Q&A, and then I believe he's going to screen the first 20 or 25 minutes of the film, which he has already edited. Mm-hmm. So you get to see the first probably third or quarter of the film, and be a part of supporting the process of, he had this really cool post the other day of showing these like kind of iconic movies made in Alaska and then showing where they're actually really shot. Massachusetts, Iceland, you know.
Yeah. Proposal was all, it was Sitka, right?
Oh, there
was like 2 shots that were from Sitka.
Yeah. It was like Sitka. And you're like, Well, that's a hell of a lot of deciduous trees in that temperate rainforest
there. We don't have any of those, and those boats and those.
Right. It's obvious. Like sweet sloop.
Yeah.
Where's the volcano?
Exactly.
We're missing that. Right. But so it's like, it's a great thing. And he's coming up in person to try to get over the finish line on that funding so that they can do all the post-production and add in some of the sci-fi kind of stuff. And it's... this Saturday the 13th at K-High, doors at 5:30, event starts at 6 o'clock, and there'll be a Q&A with the director and writer, Emilio Miguel Torres. You get to watch the first, I think, 20, 25 minutes of the completed film.
Cool. And where do you get the tickets? You buy them at the door?
I believe you can buy them at the door.
Okay.
I'm not too hip to the Facebooks, but I know he's been...
Okay.
Posting event information on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I'll have to get this out before then.
Cool.
That's this weekend. So thanks again for being on here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. It's been fun.